Hey guys, welcome to episode 193 of The True Crime Couple. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We want to welcome you to the month of December. And for you and John, I've selected cases that surround the holidays this month to get us in the festive mood.
The holiday spirit?
Yes. And we hope that all is well, and we want to thank you if you've ever or recently have left us a review on whichever podcast platform you listen to us on. We appreciate all the love and support that you show us, and it really helps us get our podcast out there. And also, if you've newly joined Patreon, please stay tuned at the end so we can give you a shout out for supporting us that way too. If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and get two additional full-length episodes a month, then you can join us at patreon.com/truecrimecouple. What we did is we actually released a bonus episode so you could hear what our Patreon episodes sound like. And right now, if you join Patreon, you would get 129 episodes.
It's a pretty good deal.
I think so. Okay, so that was short and sweet, as always. So, John, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Of course I am.
When our case began in December of 1968, the country was in a strange place. A sense of tension and sorrow could be felt through every aspect of the holiday season. At this point in history, America was fighting a war on two fronts, a social one at home through the civil rights movement, and one abroad against communism in Vietnam. In both wars, we suffered great losses that year. Just 8 months before, in April, Martin Luther King Jr., a prominent and influential leader and activist for the civil rights movement, had been assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. During the same year, America suffered through the deadliest year of the Vietnam War. 1968 alone accounted for 30% of total American deaths during the 20-year conflict. Although the late 1960s was a time that Americans were divided on many issues, experiencing those deep senses of national traumas seemed to, even if just temporarily, stitch the country together. King had been a symbol of optimism and progress. In his speeches, he discussed the idea that maybe we could begin to mend the physical and psychological scars left on our nation by the prevailing patterns of the Jim Crow era laws and segregation. At the same time, the growing outrage towards the war in Vietnam gave people hope that the government would be forced to bring the troops home, so they would stop having to die in a war that so many believed we had no place in. Maybe young American boys would not have to be drafted to fight and die halfway across the world, alone and scared. So when the loss of hope was felt by many in America after the assassination and news of the troops, some found it hard to tackle the holidays with the same sense of enthusiasm they once had. Something felt wrong about it. But putting up the decorations and starting to buy gifts felt like an obligation. Something done almost on autopilot, with a small glimmer of hope that maybe some semblance of peace could be provided in each household across the country. And that was the plan of the Mackle family that year, too. To celebrate Christmas together and hope for a better future. That was until every parent's worst nightmare, a scene right out of a horror movie, put an end to those plans as well.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another. Are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
20-year-old Barbara Mackle was not having an easy start to her holiday season for reasons other than those that were plaguing the nation. Just as finals week had begun, Barbara came down with what authorities were calling the Hong Kong flu, an epidemic that ended up causing 100,000 deaths in the U.S., and 1 to 4 million globally from July of 1968 until late 1969. Emory College, where Barbara was a student and a member of the Delta 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 sorority, had been hit particularly hard as most students on campus were showing symptoms. Despite being sick, Barbara had been determined to complete all of her finals and then return home to Coral Gables, Florida, where she would celebrate the holidays and spend her break with her parents, Jane and Robert, and her older brother, Robert Jr., who was 4 years older than her. But unfortunately, in the middle of one of her finals, Barbara's symptoms became so bad that she had to leave the exam. Her mother, Jane, drove up to Atlanta to help care for her. Jane got to the college on December 13th and assisted Barbara in getting her things together to come home for her break. The two women booked a shared room at the nearby Roadway Inn chain motel in Decatur so that Jane could nurse her daughter back to health, and then the women could leave when Barbara was ready to make the trip back to Florida. Jane didn't want to take Barbara to the hospital because she feared that the hospital in the area would have been overrun with people who were already suffering from the same flu, so she chose to nurse and care for Barbara separately in this hotel room. She also thought it would be bad to stay at the college because the flu was running rampant there too.
Yeah, I mean, what a predicament to be in, right? You don't know where to take your kid, but I mean, it's nice at least that Jane made her way all the way to the college and took care of her daughter. That's cool.
Yeah, and it's a far drive. A few times while they spent the 4 days in the motel room, the women were visited by Stuart Woodward, who was Barbara's boyfriend. He wanted to check in on her and make sure that she was all right. At 4 a.m. on December 17th, a desperate call was made to the DeKalb County authorities from the Hotel of the Mackle Women. It was Jane on the other end. She told the woman where she was, the Roadway Inn, just outside of Emory University, and that two people had just entered her hotel room and kidnapped her daughter.
This is crazy. Okay.
Like a scene from a nightmare horror movie. Law enforcement officers rushed to the scene to try and figure out just what kind of emergency they had on their hands, because they too were confused by the story that Jane was telling. Jane Mackle was distraught and hysterical about her missing daughter. She had been rendered helpless as she watched her youngest child be taken from the hotel room that they shared. Once she calmed down, she told investigators what had happened. She said that while she had been caring for her daughter, they heard a pounding at the door to the room. It had been so late, so she asked through the door who was there. She said that there were men on the other side of the door. At this point, she had opened the door enough but kept the chain lock on, so she could see people, but just a sliver of them, but it was still dark outside, so it was really hard to make out who was there. So she said that there were men on the other side of the door who said that they were police officers and that she needed to open up. She saw one man wearing a police cap and another man in the background, but she had an obscured view of him because the door wasn't open far enough because the chain was there. So she did see that the one man was wearing the police cap, so she felt safe enough to open the door.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it seems like this person is trying to look like a police officer.
Yeah. So at this point, she's feeling safe because she thinks she has identified them as police officers. And the man that was closest to her said, before she even opened the door, "We're sorry to bother you, but there's been an accident with a boy in a white Ford. He's in the hospital and he's looking for you." So at this point, Jane and Barbara looked at each other. They both assumed the officer was referring to Stuart, who had just been there earlier to visit with them. He drove a white Ford. She said that both she and her daughter were concerned. So she shut the door, took off the chain lock, and fully opened the door for both officers. As soon as she did this, the two men burst into room 137 and yelled for her to get down on the bed. It was clear to Jane at that moment that she had made a mistake and that these men had only been posing as police officers, because now at this point they had ski masks on and they were carrying a rifle.
I mean, that is really scary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's bad enough if this was to happen in a familiar place where you feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. But we all know how we feel in hotel rooms. I mean, maybe I'm the only one in this. Even if it's a nice one.
Very nervous, always in hotel
rooms. Are you actually?
Yeah, because scary things happen in hotel rooms.
So, like, I feel like that, too. Like, I feel like even if it's really nice, even if it's in a nice area, I'm unfamiliar with my surroundings. And that always plays such a major part.
And I think there's a vulnerability, especially with motel rooms like they were in, where there's access from outside to inside and you're just in a room. And another thing is we have to remember this is 1969 and the Mackles we'll get into are a very wealthy family. So things are going to be different for them. They're kind of sheltered when it comes to the world of violence, as most Americans were in 1968, because it's not something they commonly saw on their TV screens or heard about in podcasts. So this is something that's very shocking to the women. She described the first man, the one who had been speaking and yelling thus far, as a very large, imposing man. She said that he was very forceful and forced both of them down on the bed. The second man that had come in had been a lot smaller. Jane said that he was about the size of a teenager. Jane was tied up and bound by the smaller of the two, and a piece of cloth was put over her face. She explained that the cloth had a sweet smell to it and made her woozy, but she did not pass out. Later, detectives would believe that the assailants had tried to incapacitate her by using chloroform, but had been unsuccessful. Jane said that she lifted herself up and looked over to where she was hearing noises. She said that she then saw her worst nightmare. Her daughter Barbara was being forced out of the motel room at gunpoint in her sleeping clothes, just a flannel nightgown. Jane said that she couldn't react, she couldn't do anything, she couldn't move, she felt helpless and disoriented, and that everything was just happening so fast. After a while of being alone in the hotel room, her daughter having been ripped from her, she eventually was able to break free of her bindings and call the police.
I once again, that is so scary, and honestly, you cannot blame Jane here, right? That's her name? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the mother. Jane is the mother.
I mean, you cannot blame her here. What would we do? I mean, obviously we would want to scream out and do something or but if, you know, there's guns involved, there's two men.
Right.
And if no one else is coming to your aid, you're kind of just SOL.
And she's bound and her mouth is taped closed with a piece, she had a piece of cloth in her mouth. So there's nothing that she could do. But that was what was so bad to her was that she felt so helpless when, you know, your role as a parent is to protect your child. And she felt like in that moment she couldn't.
I mean, sure. And they made sure to have all the control,
mm-hmm.
which seems very planned.
Yes, this is a very planned attack. They had a reason to go in. They knew about Stewart's white Ford.
Which kind of, well, I don't want to say red flag, but there is a question flag to be had there. How long were they trailing them? Because they had to be watching the boyfriend come over. Is it possible that we're dealing with a scenario where they were being trailed for multiple days to find the right person?
That's a possibility.
Or actually, better yet, we don't know. We don't know what the husband does for work. Is there a possibility that not only is it that he's rich, but maybe he is in this prominent position somewhere, and she's being kidnapped for ransom and for maybe information or something. There could be more there.
I think you're definitely onto something because this definitely is known as like the JonBenet Ramsey case before the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Oh, okay. Very interesting.
But I don't want to give too much away, so I'll just get a little further into it.
No problem.
So Stewart, who is Barbara's boyfriend, arrived at the scene while Jane was giving her statement and the motel room was being processed. She explained to the officers that this was Stewart, Barbara's boyfriend, the man that they believed the men who came into the room were talking about. It was presumed by the officers that maybe the kidnappers had seen the white Ford there before while Stewart was visiting them, and that maybe they used it as a ploy to bring down Jane's guard and open the door for them. Jane was comforted by the fact that Stuart was there, a familiar, friendly face while she was dealing with the aftermath of this chaos. And he stayed with her while she finished talking to law enforcement and when she called her husband. When Robert Mackle heard what had happened to his wife and daughter, he headed straight up to Atlanta. Law enforcement in DeKalb County would learn quickly that they were not just dealing with any family. The Mackles were a very wealthy and prominent family from Florida, and Robert just so happened to be very close friends with J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI himself.
That's a pretty big deal.
It is. And to kind of explain that a little bit further, I just want to take a moment here to talk about the Mackles because they were a very big deal. Okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to take a break and we're going to hear about our first sponsor and only sponsor of the show. Okay, let's get back to our show. Jane Mackle was born in 1917 and came from a wealthy family herself. Her father owned a number of coal mines in Pennsylvania, and eventually he chose to relocate himself and his family to Miami Beach, where he opened a hotel. Jane did not go on to be a housewife, as most wealthy women kind of sometimes aspire to do that were born when she was around 1917. She instead went on to study economics at Duke University and worked for the FBI during World War II. She was a pioneer in her field. During this time, she married Robert Mackle in 1943. Robert had been an officer in the Navy at the time, so they had a military ceremony in Washington, D.C. Robert was one of the Mackle brothers, who were very well known in Miami. The brothers took over the Mackle Company, a real estate development company, after the passing of their father, and came into prominence after building an $18 million project for the U.S. Navy in Key West. This is kind of how like South Florida became a really big deal during World War II. The U.S. Navy used South Florida for a lot of practice because the conditions, terrain, I guess, whatever you could call it, very much mimicked what was going to be happening through French invasion. So during that time, the U.S. Navy had to find places to house these soldiers. So that's how the Miami hotels really became big.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
And they shared a part in this, especially because Robert himself was a naval officer. So that kind of respect went to that company over others because they understood the process of the Navy.
Wow.
And now that there were so many people who loved living in Florida, the brothers are going to take advantage of the fact that there are so many World War II veterans living there with their families who decided to relocate after, you know, what they had seen and gone through during the war. And the brothers popularized selling land in planned communities through installment plans. So this was wonderful because these were very affordable communities for men returning from war. So it was something that became really popular. But on the other hand, they also built really good, like, high-end communities, I guess you could say. So they had Marco Island, Port Charlotte, Port St. Lucie, Key Biscayne, which was known for its ranches, which were, again, like I told you, the affordable homes for the World War II vets. And these homes became so popular for the veterans, they started to become known as the Mackles, actually. So to say the least, the family had wealth, influence, and power. You couldn't talk about real estate in Florida without talking about the Mackle brothers. And it may have been the reason why Barbara Mackle had been kidnapped. Law enforcement officers were present when Robert Mackle Sr. arrived. N had spoken to him and noted that he kept himself calm and collected, but that his stoicism should not be mistaken for apathy. He made it very clear from the moment that he landed that he would move mountains to get his daughter back. And with pockets that deep, he just might be able to. At the time, Barbara's family was worth $30 million. And that's back in 1968. So in today's money, we're talking about $277 million. So good Christmases for the Mackles.
I'd say so.
Except this one.
Yeah, well, true. But I'd also say that now we have kind of a reason possibly as to why. I mean, it's kind of, you know, straightforward here. I mean, family has money. These people maybe are looking to capitalize on that, and they took her. So hopefully this is just a simple exchange. But at the same time, this wouldn't be true crime if
it wasn't more complicated right. than that.
Exactly.
So it also come in handy that the family knew J. Edgar Hoover, because this case was immediately going to be given to the FBI no matter what. But Hoover had the ability to put his best agents on the case. And this is something he was going to do. Ever since the Lindbergh kidnapping in 1932, kidnapping was no longer considered a local or state crime. It was federal. And the FBI would have immediate jurisdiction and were to be aided by local law enforcement. Robert had already called Hoover, and his friend assured him that he was going to put his best G-men on the case, and that a man by the name of Rex Schroeder would be heading up the investigation, and that everyone in the FBI knew this case was top priority.
I know this is going to sound bad, but it is kind of cool that you have that much pull to, like, have this kind of investigation to go down now. Like your friend is Hoover. Like, I mean, that is insane.
Well, we do see all of these families who are dealing with kidnappings be in very vulnerable situations where they feel sometimes like maybe the lead detective isn't taking them seriously or listening to them. And the Mackles have the privilege here to really call all of the shots. And, you know, that's something that wealth can get you.
I mean, that is true. And pick of the litter as far as investigators go.
Yeah, well, and the whole FBI at your disposal.
Crazy.
It's intense. Jane was questioned by the FBI agents once they arrived in Georgia. They asked her to go through the whole story again and try and recall everything that she could remember about the kidnappers. Once she had finished, they asked her if the description they gave her of Stewart's car had been accurate, and she told them that it had, that it was very accurate. Next, they asked if she believed in any way that Stewart could have been involved in the kidnapping. And Jane told him that she didn't think so, that he was like family to them, and she could never imagine him doing that. But the agents still wanted to check Stewart out. They questioned him about the relationship that he had with Barbara, and he said that everything was great. He loved her and the family. They asked him why he believed that his girlfriend had been kidnapped, and he said that he believed it was obvious, because she was worth a lot of money. He explained that everyone at school had heard about how Barbara's father was big in Florida real estate and that he had powerful friends. The agents were immediately suspicious of Stewart, and they bring up the fact that he seemed to know an awful lot about the family. Stewart said that he knew a lot about the family because he cared about Barbara and he talked to her about them. They had more questions for him. And while talking, he brought up the fact that maybe she could have been taken for money and that the kidnappers would request money soon.
What a situation to be in, though, right?
Yeah.
This is bad.
But, I mean, he's a walking red flag to the FBI agents. How the kidnappers specifically mention his car, get him, use him as a ruse to get in, and now he's the one who's mentioning how wealthy his girlfriend is, right? And in their minds, they're hearing like, well, this is why I'm dating her. And then he's saying, well, they're probably going to call and ask for ransom soon. Like, he is privy to what's going to happen in the case. These are all the things that they're thinking of him. Not to say that they're true, but of course they're going to be suspicious of Stewart.
I mean, I think it's normal. I mean, they are red flags for sure. I think it's normal for them to kind of go through this and see where it leads, because he could possibly be involved, and that would be insane, you know, that the boyfriend maybe has co-conspirators, you know, that are looking to do this kind of ruse to get money.
Yeah, I mean, it would be sad if it were true, and Jane Mackle and later Robert Mackle are going to be insistent that they really don't think Stewart has anything to do with this. He's just, you know, he's a 20-year-old kid who's nervous and kind of just blabbing away because he's talking to the FBI.
Right, exactly. And, you know, you also have to think the parents and the FBI now, especially since the connection that's there, they're not going to leave a single stone unturned.
No, they're not. Well, Stewart told them that it had been his plan to go back home for winter break and spend the holiday with his family. The FBI told him that he could do so, but he should be prepared to leave if they had more questions for him because they would call him into their local office. But they didn't just simply let Stewart go. They had him tailed and under surveillance the entire time he was on break.
Wow. Okay.
Because the kidnapping seemed to have ties with the family and not the motel specifically, the agent in charge chose to set up their investigative headquarters in the Mackle family home, which is located in Coral Gables, Florida, and leave Georgia altogether. Another reason for this, I guess I can say, is the fact that the FBI was not very happy with the way DeKalb County investigators had handled the investigation initially. So they kind of wanted to get out of Georgia and just handle things themselves. So the sheriff's office and then later the GBI was not involved in this investigation.
So it's just purely the FBI?
Yes.
Huh. Okay.
So Robert Mackle told the agents who were had now set up shop in his home that they had free reign of the mansion and that they could search or look for whatever they wanted. Like, he's like, look through my house. Everything is yours. You don't have to ask. Use everything you want. Eat anything you want. Like, I just want Barbara back.
Fair enough, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think he's not really acting. I mean, some people would say the fact that, you know, he has all this pull makes them a little bit of a spoiled family, but I don't think that's how they were acting. They were, the whole family was truly terrified and scared, and they really just kind of gave all their faith and hope to law enforcement and treated them with so much respect and, you know, were thankful that they were working so hard to try and get Barbara back.
Yeah.
At 10 a.m., the phone rang in the Mackle household. One of the many family friends that had come by to see how they could help had been the person to answer the phone. Now, this is also a connection with the Ramsey case, right? Because when, I'm sorry I keep making these connections, but that's another December kidnapping, you know? And we recently just watched that documentary on Netflix, which we recommend to everybody because it was phenomenal.
It was amazing.
And when the Ramseys reported JonBenet missing, they called their friends to come over. Well, the Mackles are going to do the same thing.
Right.
So their family friends are there as a support system. And when the phone rings, it's a family friend who picks up the phone. The woman on the other line had clearly been using a fake voice. They said, "This regards Barbara." And then a second voice could be heard. This voice had a Spanish accent and was also female. The second voice said, "Please listen carefully." The friend asked, "Who is this?" But the voice just continued with what she wanted to say. She said, "Tell the police to look under a tree in the northeast corner of the house." And then they hung up. The family friend rushed to tell Robert and the FBI agents in the home. The agents rushed to look under the tree that the mystery caller had been referring to, and they dug around it. Buried beside the tree, they found a beaker, and inside was a single piece of paper. When they got the paper out, they found a typed ransom note.
That's crazy. So So now we have a letter that was put there on the property.
In Coral Gables, Florida. Meanwhile, the kidnapping happened outside of Atlanta, Georgia.
Right. Now, listen, I know, Atlanta, Georgia is not so far away from Florida, but, you
we're
know,
talking about
still,
like
I mean, still, a
few hours of a drive.
that means that there's way more than just the two people that took her.
I would say so, because it's a considerable distance. I mean, it's almost like with traffic, it's 10-hour drive, without it, a 9-hour drive. So this had to have been very planned out.
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, think about it. I mean, you have it in a beaker. They had to dig to find it. It's not like it was put in a mailbox. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was definite planning throughout this whole entire thing.
Right. And needless to say, the FBI agents were shocked by this. I mean, they weren't used to dealing with sophisticated kidnappings. This is not how any kidnappings they had ever known or studied had gone. It seemed very well orchestrated, as the beaker had to have been buried before the kidnapping took place, and that this person needed at least one accomplice, which they knew they did have because two people were in the hotel room, but they needed another accomplice who was in the area to bury this, because the ransom note was found 670 miles away from the kidnapping site. The note starts out by demanding $500,000 in cash, which would be the equivalent of $4.6 million today. But there were other details in the note, and these were the details that terrified Barbara's family. The note read, "Sir, your daughter has been kidnapped by us, and we now hold her for ransom for $500,000. This, of course, provided relief, because that meant that Barbara was still alive. But then it continued. She has been buried alive in a small capsule in a remote piece of soil. She has a vent and a light. It has a fan. It will bring in air as long as the battery lasts," the note said. "She has enough air and food and water for a few days, but the air supply will be cut off. After that, the Mackles knew that the clock was ticking for their daughter."
That is horrifying, especially now that the parents are learning details as to how she's taken and the conditions that she's in. But, and there's a really big but here, we don't even know if she's alive. This could be a lie.
It could be. There's no proof that she's being kept alive.
Right. It's not like the letter had a picture of her on it or any way for them to seek any kind of proof that she's alive. Right. So I don't know.
Especially because of the timing. Like, this letter had to have been buried before the kidnapping took place. So for all they knew, something could have went wrong in the kidnapping and she died in the process of it. Same thing as happened with the Lindbergh baby.
Regardless of that, they're still trying to look to capitalize.
Correct.
Like, this is like a really tough position to be in, because you don't even know the current status of your daughter.
Right.
And the FBI has not a single clue as to where she could be.
Well, they're going on faith here.
Right.
The note went on to instruct Mackle to run an ad in the Miami Herald for the following day, December 18th, confirming that they would pay the ransom. Once he confirmed this, he would be contacted again with further instructions. Mackle and the FBI did just that. An ad was taken out for the following day, and it read, "Loved one, please come home. We will pay all expenses." But this also brought the case into the forefront of the media. And along with the ad being placed, the story was now front page news. The Mackles hoped this would not deter the kidnappers. The ad was placed, and they expected to hear back quickly from the kidnappers, especially because time was of the essence when it came to the situation their daughter was in. But the kidnappers took a long time to call. It wasn't until late that night, early the next morning, when the Mackles' phone rang at 3:47 a.m. on December 19th. There was a man on the other end of the line. He just started giving directions as to where Robert Mackle was to go drop off the $50,000 in cash that he had taken out. The instructions were to a causeway, which was located about 5 miles from their home. Robert asked how did he know if Barbara was still well, and the kidnapper replied, "You don't." and then hung up the phone. Robert and Jane Mackle had no other choice. They needed to take the chance and bring the cash and hope their daughter was okay. Robert Mackle left by himself with a suitcase filled with money. He followed every direction that was given to him. He had to take a specific route, wear a white suit, come by himself, and take his Lincoln to the site. And just as he was told to do, Robert placed the suitcase on the other side of the bridge. But as Robert Mackle was on the way home from following all of the directions perfectly, the FBI and his wife were waiting back at the family home with silent anticipation. But that silence was broken by the worst possible scenario. The local police radio that the FBI were tuned into was going off, and a report was going on of a suspicious male with a suitcase near the causeway. The call stated that the male appeared to be armed and that he should be apprehended. The local police were screwing up the drop-off. The FBI agents were furious.
Okay, now as much as that sucks, and I can't even believe that this is happening, I feel like this is the issue, right? Because you have both, you have the local police and you have the feds, but they're not on the same page.
No. And
that's the issue.
Well, the problem was that the FBI had not informed the local police that the ransom drop was going to happen because they feared that the local police would leak the information or that someone would intercept the money because they were tempted by the amount. So they wanted to keep all of this a secret because they thought it would interfere or jeopardize what was happening. But now they regret it keeping the secret because the local police were going to screw this up and Barbara's life is hanging in the balance.
Right. And you're leaving it up to chance. Now, I get it. You don't want it to leak out. But now look where we're at.
Oh, it's bad.
Better to be transparent and instead of letting it just like leave it up to chance.
Right. Well, we're also living in a time, 1968, where the federal police were not speaking to the local police because there was that kind of competition of who's better, what's going on, you know, like. So they listened in horror as two police officers approached the man that was being reported about and they tried to arrest him. The man, in fear, dropped the suitcase and ran. So not only did the kidnapper get away, he didn't take the money, and Barbara it was now going to take longer to get Barbara back, and she could run out of oxygen.
Not only that, but if she's alive, they find out that they tried to do a sting or like try to set them up like that,
yeah,
they could kill her.
Well, yeah, and because that is the fear too. Like, the Mackles were devastated. What just happened may have killed their daughter.
Right.
And they didn't intend it to. Now that the kidnappers did not have the money, they feared that there was no incentive to keep Barbara alive. And like you said, in retaliation, they might not if they thought that the Mackles had tried to set a trap or not give them the money in a way. So to say the FBI was pissed would be an understatement. And, you know, they were feeling like local law enforcement had been mishandling this kind of case all the way back from Georgia. And now they believe the same thing was happening from the Miami Police Department.
Well, they kind of have the right idea. I mean, it's kind of, that is what's happening.
Yeah.
A little bit.
So after consulting with J. Edgar Hoover, no big deal, Rex Schroeder, the FBI agent heading this investigation, released an official FBI press release that was directly authored to the kidnapper. And to do this, he had to get the approval of Hoover. The FBI wanted this direct plea to come from Robert Mackle. It said, "I had nothing to do with the action Thursday morning of the Miami police." Mackle then went on to urge contact through any channel. This plea was published everywhere, on TV, on the radio, and in the paper. Meanwhile, 20-year-old Barbara Mackle was beginning to lose her mind in her underground tomb.
This is crazy. It's like a sick, twisted movie. I can't even believe this is actually real.
I know. Once Barbara had been taken from the hotel room, she had been driven 20 miles north of the motel to a remote location in Duluth, Georgia. Once the kidnapper had driven off the road, they traveled about 100 feet through trees. Still at gunpoint, Barbara was brought to a specific location where the kidnappers removed tree limbs and debris from the area. Once everything was cleared, the terrified 20-year-old got a view of the coffin-shaped capsule that would soon become her own private hell. This capsule, as it was later called, had been constructed with plywood. The inside was lined with fiberglass. It was 7 feet long and 3.5 feet deep and 3 feet wide. While the man who had been driving lifted the top of the capsule, he explained to Barbara his creation. He seemed proud of it. He said there was enough food for a few days and sedative-laced water inside to slow her breathing. There was also a fan to help airflow, a lamp, a blanket, and a sweater for warmth. Barbara was also told that he installed 2 plastic pipes, which would allow air from the surface to flow into the capsule.
This is like, it sounds like Saw, like we're ready to play a game.
Yeah.
This is terrifying.
Yeah.
But hold on, I'm sorry. Let me just get the dimensions right. So it was 7 feet long.
Right.
By 3 feet high?
Well, 3.5 feet deep and 3 feet wide.
Okay, so I feel like that's really cramped.
Yeah, she's in a coffin.
My God.
And another thing that I think is important we mention here, while Barbara's in there, she's still recovering from the flu. She's very sick.
Also, she could possibly like die from that. The air is bad. Mm-hmm. She's having sedative water. I mean, This can't be good for what she has.
No, it cannot be.
Like, this whole thing is just like utterly disgusting. Like the whole thing.
It's torture.
Oh,
God. It's torture. So as she was brought into the capsule, she begged for them not to do what they were going to do. She screamed and cried. Once she was inside, she was subdued by her captors with a chloroform rag. Like her mother, she only got disoriented but did not pass out. She was still able to scream as they screwed down the lid, and she screamed some more as they covered the capsule with hundreds of pounds of Georgia clay and dirt. Just as it had been before, they covered the spot where the capsule was with leaves, branches, and tree limbs so that it would not be visible without searching hard for 2 little pieces of pipe sticking out of the ground.
I mean, these are things of nightmares, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I feel so bad.
Barbara's breath was ragged. Not only did she have limited oxygen, but she was still dealing with her flu symptoms. She knew she had to keep herself calm, and that was the only way that she would survive. While she was in the capsule, she found a note from her kidnappers that read, "Don't be alarmed. You are safe. You'll be home for Christmas one way or the other." Alive or dead, that means.
Oh, yeah, that's going to put me at ease.
The note then listed all of the amenities that they had shown her, like the fan, the light, the blanket, and the sweater. In the note, it said that the fan's batteries would last for 11 days. But only after 3 hours, the fan's batteries died. And Barbara became panicked that more of her kidnappers' plans would go wrong. Like, if they got that wrong, they might have gotten this whole construction thing wrong, and I'm not going to be able to breathe soon.
That's true. I mean, I'm sure, though, that the pipes probably still had air coming through, but still, I could understand. I mean, I'd flip out. There's a million things
that the thought of this is making me, like, I can't even think about it.
I mean, I'm not even claustrophobic, and I feel like I'd bug out.
You couldn't not.
Yeah. I mean, this is terrifying.
She hoped that whatever was happening above ground was bringing her closer to being saved. At this point, when the Miami police had botched the ransom drop-off, Barbara had been underground for 48 hours. Shortly after the drop-off attempt, a call came in stating that a car had been found near the causeway site. The thought was that the car was of the man who had tried to escape the police by foot. Well, he did escape the police by foot. The man that had been attempting to pick up the suitcase. The car was a 1966 station wagon with a Massachusetts license plate. Inside the vehicle, investigators found a rope, masking tape, ski mask, and a key for a hotel room at the Roadway Inn.
So were they staying at the same hotel?
Yes, they were.
Wow.
This was most definitely the car of the kidnappers. But there was more that had been found in the car. There were also some racy pictures. They were of a man in his 20s. He was naked except for a police cap placed strategically over his private area. So, although these kidnappers seem to have planned this out well, they stupidly took a picture of one of the kidnappers and left it in the car to later be found by police.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's kind of funny, though.
It is. So, of course, this made them think that this man was one of the kidnappers, especially because of the police cap. This was the police cap that Jane had identified as being the one that made her think that this man was a police officer and the reason why she let him in the motel room to begin with. So this meant this had to be the car that Barbara was also in. So the car was brought in and processed. Investigators vacuumed up everything in the car, and they would have to slowly sift through it in hopes of finding any fibers or hairs that could prove that Barbara had been in the vehicle. The FBI agents working the case contacted the FBI field office in Massachusetts to find out who the car belonged to. They found out that the car had been registered to a man named George Deacon. A picture was shown to Robert Mackle and his staff to see if anyone knew or recognized who George Deacon was, but none of them did. They looked into his background, and Deacon had no criminal record, and very little was known about him by any law enforcement agency. Schroeder believed that Deacon was their man and that he had to be in the Miami area. So he asked Hoover if he could get reinforcements to help him look for Deacon. Because he's like, this man escaped by foot. He didn't have a vehicle. We know he's going to want this money, so he's going to attempt to contact the Mackles again. So he has to be in Miami. Please, he begged Hoover, send me everyone you can. Hoover gave him 125 agents to assist him in his manhunt.
125?
Yep.
Jeez.
Yep. We need better friends.
Yeah, like what's going on?
Come on.
I need some connections.
Somebody needs to join the FBI. Then hours after the manhunt was underway, another phone call came in from the kidnapper. He stated that there was to be a new ransom drop site. It was to be located 2.2 miles off the left-hand side of the road off of Southwest 8th Street. This was an unpaved road on the edge of town. So they were going to attempt the drop-off again. And this time the Miami police were told to stand down.
Good.
How embarrassing for them.
Just stay away.
Like, guys, don't screw this up for us again. Like, it also then in a bad way made there to be worse relations between the federal government and the Miami Police Department. But I mean, they kind of deserved it here. Again, Robert followed all the instructions and the drop-off went as planned, safe for the kidnappers to retrieve. So now they had to wait and pray that Barbara was still alive.
I mean, this is crazy. At least we're getting another shot at the drop-off because we're hoping that they're going to get their money and we're going to get her back. That's
exactly.
Good. Yeah.
Meanwhile, the manhunt for George Deacon was still underway. The FBI agents that had been unleashed on Miami had found a man by the name of George Deacon. Deacon worked at the University of Miami, at the Institute of Marine Science. They were unable to track him down, so they met with his boss at the university. The professor confirmed that he had hired Deacon about 6 months prior. He said that he was very smart and that his credentials were impeccable. It would have been stupid not to hire him. He had hired him to pilot boats for the marine research expeditions. He said that Deacon could do many things. He could build or repair anything. He could pilot a boat, and his abilities were endless. The agents asked the professor if Deacon would have been able to construct a ventilated box. And the professor was a little surprised by this question. Well, yes, of course, he said. He could definitely do that. That's actually what I pay him to do.
What?
He explained that Deacon built ventilated boxes for their marine research expeditions for the specimens to be carried in on the way home.
Wow.
So he made one for a human.
He made a larger one, I'm sure, for a human. Oh, my God. Now, the only thing that I'm still questioning here, I know we're going to find out, but I just have to throw it out there. I'm sure someone else is thinking the same thing, though. Who and how did they bury that note on the property? Because I'm thinking, unless they live on a cross, what is it called, a causeway? What's mm-hmm. When someone's like on waterfront, mm-hmm. I'm thinking if he knows how to use a boat, then.
No, the Mackel property is not waterfront.
Okay, it's not. Okay.
No.
I'm just trying to think maybe, you know,
Well, now we know that George Deacon is located within the Miami area.
Right.
So he lives by the Mackels. So there is a possibility that they were followed, like you said.
Right.
And they were kind of stalked and staked out for a while on the way up there.
This is wild.
So George Deacon has to be their guy. But the agents knew that there had been two kidnappers, and one was reported to be the size of a teenager. So they were thinking, could this have been a student from the university?
It could be.
They asked the professor if he knew anyone to be particularly close with George Deacon. And he said yes, that Ruth was. She was a postgraduate student, and they were always together. Interesting. A female. Could Jane have mistaken the second kidnapper for a male when it was really a female? That would track with the fact that a female caller had made the first call to the Mackel home.
Right, because they were trying to like change their voice and sound different.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they asked him to explain what Ruth looked like, and he said she was small, only a little over 5 feet tall, and she was Honduran. So.
The accent. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it would explain why Jane was thinking that the second kidnapper looked like a teenager, because she's small.
It's all kind of coming together, I think.
So, could this have been the woman with the Spanish accent on the call? Everything seemed to be coming to... It's like you read, like you know what I'm going to write next.
I don't know.
Everything's coming together quite quickly at this point. And things were only going to fall together faster. At the same time the police officers were interviewing the professor, other agents were also working to find Deacon. And because they had kind of put all over the place that they were looking for a man named George Deacon, a man contacted the FBI and agents met with him. This man said that the night before, he had bought a detachable trailer from a man named George Deacon in the parking lot of a thrift store. He said that he didn't even really want the trailer, but Deacon said that he was selling it for $35, and the guy thought this was such a good deal he couldn't pass up the opportunity.
I don't blame him for $35. Wow, fantastic. Right?
It seemed like the guy wanted to get rid of the trailer in a hurry, and that's why he was selling it for so cheap. So the guy decided to take advantage of it. Inside of this detachable trailer, the man said that he found newspaper clippings about the ransom and the kidnapping. Like, dude, you leave that in the trailer?
I mean, this is a little comical. First the photo, now the news clippings. I mean, it's almost like you want to get caught, and I'm glad you do.
Well, you know what's so interesting here is that sometimes I think we look at these crimes, especially ones that have not been solved, and we think that the person who committed it is a criminal mastermind, when we really just see that it's kind of a comedy of errors, what really takes place.
Right.
It's That's interesting.
A good point. I mean, that is a good point. Like, you know, miscommunications or just departments not talking to one another.
Right.
All these little things add up to like to make
dumb
it,
luck.
Right. Dumb luck. Yeah.
So the FBI took possession of the trailer and found letters addressed to George Deacon and a man named Gary Crist. When they looked up Gary Crist's record, they found that Crist, who was 23 years old, had been arrested several times for car theft, and that 2 years prior, in 1966, he had escaped from a Northern California prison, and he had been on the run ever since. So, he was an escaped convict. It made sense that George Deacon was really Gary Crist. Could this get any more twisted? An escaped prisoner kidnapped a 20-year-old girl and held her for ransom by keeping her in an underground capsule until her father, who's friends with the head of the FBI, could pay the ransom. This is like a Karen Slaughter book. It's insane.
Wait a minute. And on top of that, got into the University of Miami.
Yeah.
As a teacher. And the credentials were great.
Yeah. Well, like a research assistant. But yeah.
But still right.
A school where he found a disciple.
Wow.
1968 was wild.
Well, you know what? And it's nothing against anybody of that time period. I'm just saying you could do anything back then. If you were able to, like, you could finagle anything.
Well, because of the way records were kept, there was no right. technology. There was no communication.
No digital technology.
Right.
No, you know,
ways to verify things.
No verification, no triple checking, none of that kind of stuff. No encryption.
Isn't that insane?
That is crazy.
So to confirm their suspicions, they ran George Deacon's prints, which he had provided for the college, with those of Gary Crist's. And it turned out that the man working for the University of Miami was not George Deacon, but Gary Crist. And they had his prints because he was in the system.
You see what you could do when you have 125 plus agents on your case?
It seems like almost this should always happen. I mean, obviously it can't.
125 agents plus.
It's that's what money gets you. A little bit of privilege, you know?
Sure, sure.
Although they were getting far in the investigation, none of it mattered to the Mackle family because they didn't have Barbara back. And they were going on the fourth day of her being missing. She's still underground.
Yeah. And with every hour that passes, there's just a little bit more concern kind of settles yeah. into you. Like, is this going to be it for my daughter?
Well,
like
every second counts here.
That's true.
But thankfully, on the fourth day, the kidnapper called the FBI office in Miramar, which is close to Miami. And I hope I'm saying that right. I'm sorry. I've never been to Florida. I apologize. And said that he wanted to give information on the Mackle girl. The woman who answered the phone asked if she could transfer the caller, but he said no. Write this down. And then proceeded to give directions to a rural area outside of Atlanta, a location that was only about half an hour away from the motel that Barbara had been kidnapped from. The man hung up. He was done with the instructions. On December 20th, FBI agents from Atlanta rushed to the location. They slowly combed the wooded area looking for signs of ventilation underground. They knew that this was a high priority. But as they searched and couldn't find anything, they were very skeptical about whether or not this was a hoax. But they prayed it wasn't, and that they would not find a dead body. And they became frantic. Finally, after about an hour of searching, an agent found two tubes sticking out of the ground. Desperately, the agents gathered and clawed at the ground with their hands until agents with shovels arrived. As the men dug through the clay and dirt, they screamed to Barbara, telling her that they were coming, that they were going to bring her home. And finally, they all took a collective sigh of relief when, as they got further down, they started to hear banging from whatever Barbara was being kept in.
Oh my God.
She was still alive. She yelled out to them, "Please don't leave me." She was desperate for them to get to her and not be alone in every sense of the word.
You have built so much suspense right now.
Are
like,
you okay?
Like I was holding my breath to find out what was happening. Don't ever do that again. Oh my
sorry,
God.
Sorry, guys. Sorry. Okay. Finally, they unearthed the capsule and pried it open with a shovel. Thankfully, Barbara was alive, but barely. She was very weak and had clearly gone through torture, being buried alive for over 3 days, 83 hours to be exact.
I mean, that is just so long to be in there and confined like that.
She lost 10 pounds in those for like 83 hours. Oh my God. It was J. Edgar Hoover himself who called Robert Mackle to deliver the news every law enforcement agent would dream to give, especially in a kidnapping, because it's very rare. "Your daughter's safe. We got her."
Wow.
Imagine hearing that. Oh my God, he must have been so relieved.
Oh yeah, the whole family.
You know what also happened to the Mackles in this situation? That even though they had all of this wealth and prominence and influence and getting the FBI involved, they became diminished to every family who is just looking to have their child returned to them.
That's true. That's a good way to put it, Kay.
And well, because it's like, it's, I understand like talking about the privilege that the Mackles had here and that not every family gets that when their child is kidnapped. But at the same time, you can't expect them to not use their influence for something like this, because any family would have taken advantage of it, you know?
I mean, any family would give up anything that they have to make sure that their daughter or their son comes home.
Right.
Or anybody in the family for that matter.
Yeah. Well, Barbara was flown immediately back to Florida to be with her parents on her father's private plane. She was stiff, dehydrated, and 10 pounds thinner than when she was first buried. Barbara would later say that the only thing, oh my God, this is, get ready to cry, guys. The only thing that kept her sane for all of that time underground was thinking about Christmas with her family.
That is so sad.
And she said that to keep her mind occupied, she would close her eyes and in her mind, she would be decorating the Christmas tree with her mother. Like she would go through the process, like trimming the branches, putting on the lights, putting on the ornaments. And she said that's what saved her.
Wow. That's so sad.
Oh, my God.
But you know what? You do what you need to do to survive. And her survival instincts were kicking in.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I would have been able to do it without losing my mind.
I think there are people that probably couldn't do it. It takes a very strong individual.
And that's what she is.
Yeah. To really just keep your mind tough.
Well, now that Barbara Mackle had been returned just in time for Christmas, the FBI could throw the entirety of its resources on catching the man and woman responsible for the crime. After the discovery of Barbara, her story became international news. And in the article, the media was specific that the kidnappers were paid $500,000 in $20 bills. Well, this caught the attention of a man who worked at the D&D Marine Supply in West Palm Beach. The day after the ransom had been paid, a man had purchased a 16-foot motorboat and paid for the all $2,240 that the boat was worth using $20 bills.
Come on, man.
There's no intelligence here, really, I feel. So he remembered thinking this is odd. And then when he read the article, he was like, oh my God, I have to call the police. He said that the man that bought the boat bought it under the name Arthur Horowitz. So now the hunt was on for Arthur Horowitz. Clearly, Crist is changing his name again. Luckily, Crist used the name Horowitz as he made his way across the Florida Intercoastal Waterway, where, and I didn't know this, that as you, I mean, but it makes sense, as you travel through the Florida Intercoastal, there's like many different locks that you have to go through. And every time you do, you have to provide proper registration and your license.
So he got caught in the Intercoastal.
Well, this is what was happening. Chris didn't have proper registration. He had bought this boat cash and hadn't been able to register it yet. So he had been telling the lock tenders that he lost his registration, and most of the tenders were letting him go. And he was working his way through the Intercoastal almost out to the Atlantic, except for when he made it to the final lock in Fort Myers. And there, the lock tender told him that he couldn't let him through because he didn't have the proper registration. And he got kind of upset. And Chris was told, you know, I'm going to call the authorities. And when Chris was told this, he took off on foot onto Hog Island, which is a 30-square-mile island just off of Fort Myers. So the police knew he was stuck on this island. It took 12 hours, but finally, Crist was captured after a massive manhunt. He admitted that his accomplice's name was Ruth Eisenman. Ruth actually became the first woman on the FBI's most wanted list.
Wow. Okay.
Crist had been planning a large scheme like this since he was a child back in Alaska and Utah, where he had grown up. He was a career criminal. And this was supposed to be his big hit, enough for him to leave the country, as he was a fugitive in the United States because he had escaped that prison in Florida. He explained to the FBI agents that questioned him what had happened and why. Chris said that he had gone down to the downtown Miami library and checked the social registry, which is a book that listed prominent families. From there, he made a list of potential kidnap victims. From there, he whittled it down until he was left with only one name, Barbara Jane Mackle.
So that's how he did it.
Yep.
Okay. That makes sense. That, like, I get why or how he got to
her. How he got to her.
Right. Okay.
On the way out of Miami, he and Ruth stopped by the Mackle home and buried the ransom note on the lawn under the tree in the northeast corner. So I looked up where this house is located, like the address, and did like a Google map kind of search. And it's on a street. There's no fences. So it's very easy to get onto the front lawn of this property. So when you're looking at the house, the tree that they're referring to is on the left-hand side, and it's right by the street, like right next to the street on the edge of the property line.
Okay.
So it would have been easy for them to do that undetected, especially if they did it at night.
I guess in my mind, I was thinking of a more secure kind of home.
Secluded, yeah.
Since they had money, like, yeah. I'm thinking fences.
It wasn't as elaborate as I thought the house was going to be.
Okay.
It's what you would consider a wealthy home, but not like an elaborate mansion estate.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking to like a modern day.
That's what I was thinking.
And that's why I was thinking, how did no one go undetected? In my mind, I even said, could it have been like a housekeeper or a gardener? Oh my God, yeah. Jinx. Something like that.
Right.
But.
So Next, after they printed the note under the tree, they went up to Miami and followed Barbara from the college to the motel where she went with her mother. They didn't account for her being sick. They thought they were going to kidnap her from school.
Okay.
He said that he stole the policeman's cap at a restaurant to use as a ruse, and that Ruth had taken the picture of him in the hotel room. And when the time felt right, they chose to strike. They had seen Stewart's car a few times, so they knew that that would get them in. Crist was officially arrested and kept in custody while he awaited his trial. Meanwhile, 3 months later, Ruth Eisenman, who was born El Hotel, was arrested after applying for a job in Norman, Oklahoma. Ruth prepared a statement with her attorney and presented it to the FBI. She explained in it that she had met George Crist when she had started working with him in September of 1968. So she only knew him for 2 months when she agreed to do this with him. She said that they fell in love within the first month of knowing each other. And it was in that time that they spoke about running away together. He had convinced her that they would need money to do this, and there was a good way to do it. He told her of his dream of committing the perfect crime, to kidnap some spoiled rich girl and hold her for ransom. Once they got money, he told her that they could leave the country and live like kings. Ruth said that they got separated after the failure of the first money drop. She said that she had been waiting in the car while Crist went to get the money. But when he didn't come back, she assumed that he had taken the money and abandoned her. So she left and took a bus to Houston, leaving the car where it would later be found by law enforcement.
This is crazy.
Ruth had a very difficult childhood in Honduras. And I think that in learning about what had happened to her growing up, that Crist definitely took advantage of her need for love and desire to be accepted. She was very intelligent, but extremely gullible. And she went along with this. I mean, how could you have been there while he was burying this other woman alive? Sat there and waited to kidnap someone. She was very much involved in this. She was an accomplice, and I believe in some ways more than an accomplice. Like, it was the both of them together doing the same thing.
Oh, definitely. I mean, together they stalked their victim. They pretty much did.
Like, I don't think Ruth would have committed this crime without Gary Crist. I think I said George Crist before. I'm sorry. Entering into her life. But she certainly chose to do it quite readily and quickly.
Listen, she's young, she's impressionable, and she was vulnerable. I mean, I think that he knew exactly what he was doing and knew that he can do this to her. I mean,
yep, I agree.
You know?
Sorry, I got his name messed up. He just has so many names. It's insane.
You know what? It's okay. We all know that he's just not a good guy.
Yeah. So Chris' time awaiting sentencing was an interesting one. It seemed that Gary Crist wanted to cement his status as a criminal mastermind. So, to do so, he confessed to 3 murders and hinted at there being a 4th. Like,
really?
He just didn't want to go down for the kidnapping of Barbara Mackle, who survived and he didn't get away with the money. So, if he was going to go to prison, he was going to be a king there. And he knew, in being in prison, that you're a king there if you do something like commit multiple murders.
So taking lives, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, they worded the... So this is all the killings that he said that he had committed. And the wording is from the 60s. So it's not correct. But when Crist was 14 and living in Pelican, Alaska, he confessed to killing a 65-year-old man he was having a sexual relationship with. The translation of that, if this is true, meant that he was being sexually abused by a 65-year-old man, and he confessed to murdering him. Crist said that while they were walking across a bridge over a deep ravine, that he tripped the man, who fell to his death.
Okay. I'm just wondering if these stories are real.
Well, the death of this man at the time, 9 years prior, had been listed as an accident. So it did happen. It was just said to be an accident. He's saying he did it on purpose.
Right. But he's just like changing out a word or two and saying I was involved. Like,
and
you know,
he might have been.
Or he might not have. You know, that's up for debate, I guess.
The way that this man died was that they were walking across a bridge on a ravine. He fell in. Gary Crist told police it was an accident. They believe this boy, who just watched the 65-year-old mentor to him, who was really sexually abusing him, fall to his death. So they believed the boy.
Okay.
So we don't know if he tripped him or not.
Gotcha.
Then he said 4 years later, he beat and strangled to death a woman near San Diego. Authorities were able to put together that Crist was talking about the murder of Helen Crow, whose body had been found on October 3, 1964. However, her time of death had been determined to be 6 to 8 weeks prior, which was when Crist was in prison in California, meaning he could not have committed the murder. However, he did know a great deal about the crime scene and injuries to the body. So either the coroner got the time of death wrong, or he ran into the person who really killed Helen Crow through, you know, his prison sentences.
It's interesting because it's like he could be involved based on what he's saying.
Yeah.
But there's not enough to really corroborate that. It's interesting, actually.
It is. Hmm. And there's more.
Okay.
The third homicide he confessed to was right after he had escaped from jail in Utah. Yes, he escaped from prison twice. He said he had picked up a gay man outside of Wendover, Utah, and killed him in a fit of rage. He said that he left the body near Wendover, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right. When they looked into it, the authorities were able to determine that a skeleton was discovered on July 12, 1967, and that could be the person he was referring to. However, it's never been connected with anybody. And there was no way to prosecute Crist for any of these crimes because there was no solid evidence against him, and he also kept going back and forth with his confessions about them. So he was messing with the police, I think, and he might have been responsible for some of them or all of them, but he was willing to take theoretical accountability, but not criminal accountability for any of them.
Right.
So at first, the prosecutor sought the death penalty for the cruel and unusual punishment of Barbara Mackle. However, he had been diagnosed with borderline schizophrenia by a prison psychiatrist. Side note, this is no longer a formal diagnosis, as it is an outdated combination of borderline personality disorder and schizophrenia. Now, it is possible for these conditions to occur together, but we're unsure of what a psychiatrist would have diagnosed him with today. Because of this, Crist was sentenced to life in prison as the death penalty was off of the table because of his diagnosis. While in prison, Crist refused to give up hope that he would get out. His first attempt was to write a letter to Barbara, apologizing for what he did. This did not work, as Barbara did not respond. Next, he wrote a memoir, thinking this would sway public opinion in his favor. Surprise, it did not, and it's not worth reading. Next, he tried to escape prison, but was found hiding in the garbage truck before he could get out.
But he almost got out again, it seems like.
He almost got out a third time.
What is going on? This guy's like Houdini.
It's wild. He then focused on another strategy. He took college classes, became an EMT in prison, and worked at the prison hospital. He then befriended the chair of the Georgia Parole Board. After just 7 years behind bars, he was eligible for parole because of his diagnosis. The friend that he made on the board of parole, Tommy Morris, convinced everyone on the board that Crist was not a danger and that he would return to Alaska to work in his family's shrimp business if he were to get out.
Oh boy, here we go.
Barbara, who had since married, it said that Barbara married her college sweetheart, so it might be Stuart, might not be. We don't know what happened after. She might have started dating someone else, I don't know. But at this point, Barbara had married, and she didn't oppose the parole. She was done with the ordeal. And not because Barbara didn't oppose it, but because of what this guy did and his influence that he had over the parole board, this Tommy Morris, Gary Crist walked out of prison in 1979 when he was 33 years old.
That's crazy.
He tried to go to medical school after leaving prison. However, he couldn't because of his criminal record. Good, right?
Yeah, fantastic.
Well, he requested and received a pardon from the governor of Georgia, because that's where the kidnapping happened, at the behest of Tommy Morris. Gary Crist attended medical school in the Caribbean and for a short time practiced medicine in an Indiana town until everyone in that town found out about his past and his medical license was revoked due to a failure to report a disciplinary incident that had happened during his residency. So on a technicality, they were able to get rid of his medical license. But he was a doctor in a small town.
I mean, what better way to stay hidden, though, mm-hmm. right? That's crazy. Oh, my God.
And
this guy.
So after that, he was stripped of his medical license. He really didn't have like a solid way to support himself. So he was doing odd jobs here or there. But the next time we hear from Gary Crist was when he was arrested in March of 2006 off the coast of Alabama in a sailboat with 31 pounds or 14 kilograms of cocaine.
All right. Now we know how he was making his money after his life as a doctor.
Yes. He was sentenced to 5 years and 5 months in prison. He was released in 2010. But in 2012, he violated his parole by leaving the country and going to Cuba and South America. For this, he was sentenced to another 40 months. Ruth ended up serving 4 years in prison for the crimes that she committed with Gary Crist. Crazy, right? You would expect a lot more. And you would expect the fact that after Gary Crist had escaped prison twice, did this whole kidnapping scheme, and also confessed to the murders of three other people, that he wouldn't be able to convince a parole board, but he still was able to use his charm to get out of prison again.
Yeah, I think it's also the time period, right? I think I hate to just slap it all on that, but I feel like it plays a large role in this. I think this is like before the time of just like a study of behavioral like patterns, and would this person actually truly like, you know, do it again, or would you know, it's before all that.
Yes, the whole behavioral science thing didn't come into play yet. And also, let's not forget, he got parole in Georgia. I think it would have been a different case if he had been imprisoned in Florida, because the people of Florida felt very connected with that case because of the Mackle connection there.
Fair point. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, you're right.
Well, and this is the only part that matters, right? Barbara Mackle went on to marry and have four beautiful children and celebrate many, many Christmases with them. She is a survivor in every sense of the word.
I love to hear that. Yeah. It's nice that we get to hear a good ending to these cases. You know what I mean?
I mean, she probably definitely had to deal with a lot of trauma.
Sure.
She did go on to, you know, talk about the experience once, author a book. That's where I got a lot of the information, which I'll link.
But I'm glad that she was able to actually, like, you know, enjoy her life and have a family and be happy as best as she can. And that's all that we could ask for.
It can. And it's just, I can't even imagine that hell that she went through. So I'm glad that she was able to, you know, go on to have a good life.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Crazy town.
Great case. I can't believe the whole Hoover in your back pocket.
And this
I can't
like believe not talked about.
No, I mean, I've never heard of it. It's crazy.
Crazy. Crazy town.
Well, thanks, Kay.
Well, you're welcome. Anything for you guys and you, John.
Well, thank you.
Okay, before we go, we want to say thank you to our new supporters on Patreon. We hope you're enjoying all of the new bonus episodes you get to listen to. So thank you to Nat, Rihanna McGee, Joanne Morgan, Ashley Miracle, Tara, Jill Sandford, Vanessa, Lily, Catherine, Tiffany Sarah, Lee, Sophie, Mary, Alex Weix, the newly engaged Melissa Marcourt, Miranda Musseline, Amanda Harvey, Mallory Francesi, Raylene Del Rio, Haley Napier, Stephanie Bloomfield, Beth Melville, Gail Ann, Silk Sangelio Stan, Samantha Johnson, Linda McHardy, and Lily Harvey. Thank you so much.
Well, until next time, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.